Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to Heritage Radio Network's We Dig Plants. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg. Carmen DeVito, my co-host, is still on the beach in Florida. She's having her own plant fun, swishing around in the water, hopefully getting tangled up in seaweed. It's just me today, but we have a great guest and a great topic. It's January, and there's very little gardening going on here in the Northeast. But as gardeners, we're all dreaming of our spring garden, and we're starting to plan what will give us the most satisfaction. And, you know, we start to pore through catalogs and drool over magazine photos, and we start to do some research to mimic some of those plants that are that we're coveting in magazines. And then, of course, you know, we become worried about our geographic location and the neuroses sets in and how that translates to the photo and how we can get that plant that we're coveting. What should we do? Well, today's guest helps us. He's got the key to our neuroses. His name is Andrew Keys, and his great book is just out. It's called Why Grow This When You... Or I'm sorry, Why Grow That When You Can Grow This? 255 Extraordinary Alternatives to Everyday Problem Plants. And it was also just listed in the Martha Stewart Magazine Winter Reads book selection. So it's very timely. A brief intro. Andrew Keys is a writer, designer, consultant, and a lifelong gardener. He's the host and producer of Fine Gardening's Garden Confidential podcast. He blogs at Garden Smackdown. He grew up in Mississippi with a farming, with a cotton farming family, and he was raised with a reverence for the land. He fell in love with plants via the woods of his childhood home. He's an accredited organic land care professional by the Northeast Organic Farming Association, and he's a member of the Garden Designers Roundtable and Garden Writers Association, and has lectured for the Northeast Wildflower Society. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, Alice. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
I hope to be able to cure your neuroses, like you
Well, you've got the key, Andrew. Andrew Keys. So you're calling us from Boston, and tell us about the inspiration for the book and how it came about.
Well, I guess it's that I have always, as a gardener, I've always wanted to grow things that I couldn't grow.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the South, and early on in you know my career in plants, I discovered a book called simply Drought Tolerant Plants, and these are plants that come from Mediterranean climates, desert plants, things like that. These are not plants that would ever be happy where I grew up in the South,
right,
where we have very poorly draining soil, high humidity. But these were the plants that I really wanted to grow.
That's
and I
so
tried
funny.
And failed miserably.
The grass is always greener.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
And then I moved to the Northeast and shockingly found that I missed the plants that everybody in the South grows.
Right.
That I had grown with great success in the South.
Right.
So at some point it occurred to me, you know, I'm really tired of sort of zone pushing can always be fun to a degree, but I was really tired of trying things that clearly weren't going to work. And I started thinking, you know, I wonder what similar plan is out there that could evoke the same emotion
right.
that I could grow, that could thrive for me here in my climate. And that was really the inspiration for the book.
Yeah, I love in your preface where you mention evolution and the amazing fact that sometimes on two sides of the globe, there are two similar plants with similar flowers evolving.
Yeah.
And how that can transport us to, you know, other faraway places.
Right.
And that's what's great about your book, is that it gives us some really great alternatives for that same texture or color, the same feel, but things that will work in your region, whatever that may be.
Right. Yeah, well, thank you. The way that plants have evolved really fascinates me. I mean, a lot of times it's not even, you'll find plants of the same genus on opposite sides of the globe that are very similar.
Right.
But it's even more fascinating when they're plants that are completely unrelated, mm-hmm. that are somehow very similar. You know, there's been a lot of DNA research going on in the plant world and reclassification of plants and families, and it's been discovered that some plants that people thought were related, it turns out, are not as related as they thought.
Exactly.
And then we didn't think we're related, and it turns out they are. So, yeah, it's really interesting to me.
So another like, super fun thing about your book, I thought, was the way that you liken plant selection to high school. And like, those superstars, you know, versus, like, you know, there was, like the cheerleader or the, like, prom queen and king and, you know, those, like, people that were so sought after, you know, as far as like social norms go. And then there's just the normal people, you know, and that's kind of what your book is about, is those kind of normal people and like how they can be stars, you know?
Yeah. Well, it occurred to me that so many of these plants are great when we buy them.
Uh-huh.
And then we plant them and they grow up to be not so great.
Right.
Or they just die, or, you know, they get diseases or things like that. And I was trying to think of a good sort of overarching analogy for the entire book. And for some reason, the concept of the high school reunion hit me. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of like when the people who you thought were so great in high school show up at the reunion, and it turns out
they're bald and they're fat.
They're not the greatest anymore.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
And you know, the kids from the nerds and the geeks and the kids from the AV club, like, those are the kids that ended up being really successful.
Exactly.
And so I was thinking about these other plants that are kind of underdogs to the popular plants.
Yeah.
And that's how it hit me.
Yeah, it's an amazing analogy, and you know, it's kind of it's just wonderful because I think everybody relates to it, and it's a good way of highlighting those other plants, you know, those things that and bringing them out into cultivation and into popularity, you know, because there are some really great plants. You don't have to stick with, you know, the 25 superstars that you see in the front of the garden center when you walk in there, you know, because they've been pushed up to the front so that they're sold and, you know, gotten out of there. So,
right. Or the plants that everyone is growing or, you know, things like that.
Right.
So,
right. Well, I want to get into some of the plants. So let's start. I also really, really liked the way that you broke the, I mean, it's a very simple way that you kind of classified the book or sectioned the book. You know, there's the tree section and the shrub and the vine and the perennials and grasses and ground covers. And that's actually a really nice way of thinking about garden design and planning as kind of parts of the society or the ecosystem. And then, of course, you liken that further as you start reading more into more high school analogies. So, for instance, you say trees are the big kids in the schoolyard of the garden, which I really liked. So, one thing that I, Carmen and I, as a garden designer, we're always confronted with Italian cypress. You know, a lot of our clients will, you know, they travel to Italy and they come back and they say, ah, oh, I need to have that Italian Cypress. And we're like, ugh, you know, like you just can't. You just can't here.
Yeah.
But.
Not here. And your clients are all in New York, right? Or in the Northeast.
Yeah.
So
then.
That's a no-go.
So you turn to your great book, Why Grow That When You Can Grow This? And there it is, this beautiful alternative, the Degroot Spire Arborvitae. There it is.
Yeah.
So tell me, how did you do the research?
You know, I let me think back. I think the first thing that I did was to generate the list of plants that I felt like people wanted to grow most that were problematic for whatever reason, whether it was like Italian cypress, you know, that's a Mediterranean plant. It only really grows well in the parts of this country that have Mediterranean climates. Mm-hmm. So with that one, it's kind of it's a hardiness issue.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, a soil drainage. That's a whole host of issues with
right.
that plant.
But I think what people
but
are...
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, for us, what people want is that design, that structure, you know, that vertical
right.
element and that look.
Exactly.
And,
and
that's
and there are so many great plants that you can get that from that
right.
are not so, they're not so well known in the sort of, in the popular psyche. They may not be on a client's radar unless that client is more plant savvy, but they're still fairly available
mm-hmm.
in terms of, you know, we could probably go out to most any nursery and find several Degroot Spire arborvitae.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't necessarily be looking for them unless we wanted something like Italian cypress or something very vertical and evergreen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, some of it was generating the list of the plants with potential problems. And then I had kind of built up a list of plants that I thought were underdogs or underused. And so there was a bit of connecting the dots and then seeing, okay, what's left here? What, you know, what other plants would be good alternatives for these problem plants that may be underused or maybe somewhat available, but not necessarily planted very much.
Okay.
Things like that.
So when you were doing the research, you kind of worked at it from both sides then of the problem, like the popular plants, so to speak, and then also like the underdogs or, you know, so, and then you
Correct.
Kind of just like you said, connected the dots and you just kind of drew the
right.
connections and like, if not this, then this. And
that's
what makes the book so easy to understand. And also just your quick little brief synopsis, I think, of each plant mm-hmm. and, you know, its zone and what its general conditions are. And I mean, it's just a really easy, great, fun book to read. I was really, really impressed with it.
That's great. Thank you. I mean, I think one of the biggest things that we wanted to get out of this book was we wanted to make it simple enough that a beginner could pick it up and really get something out of it, but engaging enough that an intermediate gardener could also pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And while they may know Degroot Spire arborvitae and know that, no, maybe I don't want to plant that, it could at least be a jumping off point for them.
Exactly. And it gets them thinking.
So, yeah, we really wanted to target a range of people and have it resonate with lots of different people for different reasons.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was part of the thinking behind that.
All right, well, when we come back, we have to take a bit of a break. Hang on the line. When we come back, we're going to talk more about specific plants. And you're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We're talking with Andrew Keys.
You're listening to Bang Bang Sun by Iggy Dean on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Yeah. Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
We all know what a foodie is, but what's foodiness?
Foodiness is turning us into those chubby, slushy, slurping, lounge chair-bound morons in WALL-E, plugged in, pumped full of sugar, and brain dead.
Chef Erica Wides is here to fight against foodiness.
You have to keep drinking the Let's Get Real Kool-Aid for it to start to work.
Let's Get Real. Rediscover real food every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. As I drink my Coca-Cola, Erica, I hope you're not listening. Andrew, we are here with Andrew Keys, and he's author of the book Why Grow That When You Can Grow This, 255 Extraordinary Alternatives to Everyday Problem Plants, published by Timber Press. So, Andrew, let's go to shrubs. They're the popular cool kids, right?
Yes. Yeah. Shrubs are, that's what everyone tends to have, I think.
Right. Those poor shrubs that are stuffed in front of people's houses by developers.
Yeah, pretty you know? Much. The foundation planting.
Right. So let's talk about, there's a real problem this year, boxwood, right? You call it the everyday problem. Buxus species and different cultivars. There's a blight here all along the East Coast.
Yeah.
So you give a great alternative, and it's one that Carmen and I can't stress enough. We love and we use all the time Ilex glabra, inkberry. We use a cultivar called Shamrock a lot. Because it has the same sort of habit as boxwood, but it's not so fussy. And actually, I like its kind of looser texture a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
More
yeah,
than
yeah, it's a native plant, too.
Uh-huh.
I believe it's a native of pretty much the whole Northeast.
I think so, yes.
I mean, that's even better.
From Nova Scotia to Florida.
Anytime you can use native plants, it's all the better. So, yeah, inkberry is great because, it really has the same sort of texture and everything is boxwood. It's evergreen. There are several different cultivars. You know, one objection to inkberry that I hear from people is that it will get a little leggy.
Yeah.
As long as you prune it a little, it should be fine. But there are also cultivars that are more compact. If you are looking for the sort of more compact look of a boxwood.
If you're looking for that Downton Abbey look.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think a lot of people don't realize just how big boxwood can get, too.
Yeah.
So I guess it depends on which type of boxwood look you're looking for. But yeah, there's a range of cultivars for this plant. It's a native plant, super easy to grow. It's really tough to beat.
And then one of my also favorites that Carmen and I actually plant, Daphne, all the time. We love it. But it is very, very temperamental. And if it's not happy, it's going to let you know, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's going to let you know, and that's going to be the end.
Yeah, then you're going to rip it out. Right. Right.
I actually know a woman who, and Daphne is one of the funniest ones because they're so, even scientists don't all agree on what its major problem is in terms of there's this concept of the Daphne death, where all of a sudden your Daphne will decline and then they just poop out.
Right.
And there are various reasons. I think one of the biggest reasons that there is some consensus around is drainage.
Mm-hmm.
And especially winter drainage. I know a woman who loves Daphne, Carol Mackey, so much that she treats it as an annual. I mean, she will buy a couple of shrubs every year because they die every year.
Yeah.
And I mean, she's not ready to let go.
Right.
But for those of us who are, there are a lot of great alternatives out there that are still very fragrant and beautiful plants and some were underused. Clethra is one, summer sweet or sweet pepper bush, which is an also a native of the Northeast. It blooms kind of late summer, usually, when or kind of in the dog days of summer when not a lot else is necessarily blooming. And you smell it all around the yard.
Yeah.
That's one really great plant.
Yeah, and I also love your third alternative with sweet olive, osmanthus.
Yeah.
That's
one that I wish I could grow.
That is an unbelievable plant.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I was my husband, his family lives in the eastern part of Tennessee outside of Knoxville. And there's great hiking trails, you know, of course, all through there. And there was, I was running, I was there in the fall and I was there in the early spring. And I was, and at both times of the year, as I was like running down this path, you know, just having a little jog, I was intoxicated with like, what is that smell? What is that smell? It smells like Daphne. It smells like Daphne. And I would ask passerbys, like, what, do you know what this is? Because I couldn't see any flower. But there was this like beautiful waxy green, and I was like, "Is that Mahonia? No, Mahonia doesn't smell like that. What is this?"
Yeah.
And then I realized it's the sweet olive, and I was in heaven. It's an amazing plant, amazing, and it gets big.
It gets huge. I mean, in New Orleans, there are just huge hedges of it everywhere. I mean, that's one of the plants that I grew up with that I wish I could still grow and have actually tried to grow. So that's really, that was sort of a working backwards.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, if that's, you know, for people in the South, Daphne is not necessarily with Daphne likes good drainage. There's a lot of clay soil in the South, so you don't necessarily get that.
Right.
And it's very hot in the summer. And it's wet in the winter. So Daphne is across the board going to be a bit more difficult to grow in the South. So sweet olive, I think, is kind of the no-brainer alternative there.
Yeah.
And on the West Coast, too, they have a lot of sweet olives. So, yeah, that's really one of my favorite plants ever.
Absolutely. Was it hard for you, Andrew, when you were putting the book together, like, geographically to kind of think about that? Because, you know, like, one, you know, it's like one person's trash is another man's treasure. You know what I mean? And like,
oh yeah,
some people have these like, and some people, you know, have a little microclimate and things work great, and then others don't. So I can imagine that might have been kind of conflicting when you were putting together the book, perhaps.
It was tough. I think that was the tallest order in terms of choosing good alternatives to these sort of traditional garden favorites. Was trying to pick plants that would represent the vast majority of North America. That was three alternatives that would cover most of the continent. And that was the toughest part. I'm really lucky in that I connected with a great community of garden folk online all across the country and the continent. And so if I kind of had a good list put together, but if I was questioning something, I could always shoot someone an email and say, "Hey, what is this like for you? You know, is this boring there? Does everyone grow this? Or this seems like something that would grow for you. Have you ever heard of it? Am I right or wrong?"
Yeah.
And that was incredibly helpful. I couldn't have done it without my friends all over the country.
Well, and it's great. In the back of the book, you know, you have references and resources. So it's not like if you can't find these things at your local garden center, you can go online and you can, you know, tap into a larger community to get what you need, which I really, really appreciated in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Vines, not to be forgotten on the playground. Tell me who those kids are. Unfortunately, we all know them.
They're kind of in your face.
Yeah,
the vines.
Like our friend Asian Bittersweet. So tell me.
Bittersweet.
Yeah. I liked, of your alternatives, my favorite was the Gloriosa Lily. Beautiful plant.
Pretty plant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one that's not, that is definitely for people in milder climates. Although from what I understand, it makes a good container plant.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not necessarily a book for container planting, but, you know, I think that it does. And it's also, it stays fairly small, too, so smaller gardens also a good thing.
Right.
Yeah, when in looking for alternatives to bittersweet, I was really looking for vines that would, it's something that evokes the same idea as the plant that you really wanted to grow. And so I was looking at vines that had some feature that included the hot color,
mm-hmm.
the bittersweet, that's what we know bittersweet for,
mm-hmm.
but that didn't want to take over the world,
mm-hmm.
and become invasive species.
Right, right.
Things like that. So Gloriosa lily has these really beautiful bicolored flowers. They're half of them is red and half of them is yellow.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really pretty hot color. That was one that I really wanted to include, and it bittersweet seemed somewhat sensible in that.
Right, right. And Japanese honeysuckle, you know, what an amazing plant, but what a nuisance, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just, where is this plant not an invasive species?
Yeah,
It is just, it's wild.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure it's an invasive species here in Massachusetts where I live.
I'm sure,
and
it
was absolutely one where I grew up. I mean, it was in the woods all behind the house,
mm-hmm.
where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
There are some plants in the book that I offer alternatives to that they're actually plants in the same genus, and honeysuckle is one, that are such great plants that there wasn't necessarily even a need to go outside of that. I mean, there are such great honeysuckles that are native plants,
mm-hmm.
that it's like we could absolutely use a honeysuckle like Major Wheeler as an alternative to the Japanese honeysuckle.
Right.
There's another one that's a native, a cultivar of a native of the Midwest called Lonicera reticulata, Kinsley's Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
That one has a really pretty flower, very similar to Japanese honeysuckle.
Mm-hmm.
But then after the flower fades, there is a bract around the flower, which is kind of a modified leaf, I guess to put it really simply. And it has this silvery color, and it looks like eucalyptus. And those actually hang on to the plant for the rest of the growing season. So that's a good example of one that I feel does the original plant one better.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this plant is very similar to the original plant, but then it's also better in these ways. It provides multi-season interest, things like that.
The thing though,
and that was kind of
the thing that's sad though,
sorry,
about the Japanese honeysuckle is that that fragrant. You know, that smell,
mm-hmm.
like it's not really found in the other cultivars.
Yeah, it's tough to find. And sometimes, you know, usually, I think ideally you find a plant that hits all of those notes that the original plant hits. And often you will have to give something up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I said, you know, about the woman that I know who will replant Daphne every year.
Right.
She's not ready.
Right,
when
right.
you're ready, you know, it's time to look for these plants that will evoke something similar.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there will probably be trade-offs. It will never be that exact plant.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely will it ever hit every note. And fragrance is definitely one that can be more tough.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the book emphasizes more traditional sort of design elements like color and shape and texture and things like that. Those are typically, from what I found, those are easier to match.
Right. Right.
And I, in my mind, matching those in terms of Japanese honeysuckle was more important necessarily than matching fragrance. People will absolutely disagree with me.
Oh,
I feel,
I think you're absolutely right, because you have to weigh fragrance versus like taking over your garden, taking over the world, you know, like come on.
Right, right. But again, what I always tell people is the book is just a jumping off point. If the alternatives there don't suit you for whatever reason, then I hope that they got the gears turning, you know, maybe you're not ready to give up. But
right.
If you are, then you can look at the alternative that I had sort of specified for your climate and say, well, I don't like this for this reason, but maybe this plant here would be a good alternative for me.
Right.
So the good thing about honeysuckles is that there are others. I think that there are lots of others that aren't sort of crazy invasive species and that do have that fragrance.
I do have to say I loved the color on the Major Wheeler variety.
Yeah.
Oh, that was just
so pretty.
That was just like, you know, that was just gorgeous. It just sucked me right in. And it is so beautiful that I think you can forego the fragrance, you know, and just plant some lilies next to it or something.
So that
you get that smell. Okay, let's go to the perennials as the complicated kids.
Yeah. They die back every year.
Yeah.
Some are big, some are small. There's a whole range.
Yeah, yeah. So one that we use here a lot, Carmen and I use, is Astilbe. And we have a we have a bad pun. Astilbe, planting Astilbe is our bad pun every time we plant it. And the alternative, which we have used before and we need to use more of, I was happy to see you included Persicaria.
Fleece
flower. Great, great suggestion.
I love Persicaria. If you look, you'll actually find, I think, three different Persicarias in the book.
Uh-huh.
I kind of have a thing for Persicarias. The one that I like as an alternative for Astilbe is the small, I think it's Persicaria affinis.
Mm-hmm.
And the common names for all of these are not, they're not really representative of what the plants are. They'll call them fleece flowers or foam flower, things
right,
like that.
Right.
This particular one is very small. It's kind of ground hugging and it spreads a little and it has, these sort of little pink candle-like flowers over a really long season, and it will take more sun than a Astilbe too. The place that I've seen it growing off the top of my head more than anywhere else is a nursery in New Hampshire, and they have it planted in their rock garden.
Uh-huh.
Well, good drainage, decent water, not great, but it's in full sun in their rock garden. And it blooms over a really long period. And at some point I was like, what is that? I keep noticing that. It's really pretty. The other thing is that in the fall, its leaves turn a nice reddish color. You don't often get fall color on perennial plants.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really long season of interest on this plant.
All right. Well, in the interest of time, I have to skip over a couple of the other perennials. I know, I'm sorry. I wish we could talk more. Let's go quick, though, to the grasses and the ground covers and Bishop's weed, which is now on the invasive list. And I love that your alternative was creeping raspberry. I thought that was such a brilliant suggestion. Just a great plant that Carmen and I actually use a lot.
Yeah, I love that plant, too. It's so textural. It's like a whole pile of crushed velvet.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's really great. And I've seen it, I think, on the High Line, actually. They have it kind of trailing over one of the stairways that you exit from.
They do.
Yeah, it's a plant that will spread. Like, a lot of people want the variegated Bishop's weed.
Yeah.
This isn't variegated, but I found a lot of people cultivating Bishop's weed because it was growing at their house already, and they were like, oh, this plant spreads great. You know, I wanted a plant that would spread and be a great ground cover, but then they don't realize that it wants to take over the world. This plant is pure evil in my mind. This is one that I don't like at all.
The Bishop's weed.
Creeping raspberry will... Oh, yeah, sorry, the Bishop's weed. Creeping raspberry will spread in a similar way and be a great ground cover, but you can keep it in check. And that, I think, is the key in terms of ground covers.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that, right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly the... Because what you want is ground cover, but you don't want suffocation, you know, which is...
Ground conqueror.
Yeah, ground conqueror, right.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew, I'm sorry we are out of time, but the book is fabulous. And, of course, I think you and I could just talk for hours on plants. And hopefully I'll get to meet you up in Boston in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we're there for the trade show. So I will look you up then. But as you can see... you know, Andrew is advocating choices, and that is a great, you know, I think he says, also in his preface, he says that you know, it's a tired turn of phrase, but the grass is always greener on the other side. And as human mm-hmm. beings in general, gardeners especially, why are we always coveting what we can't have? Which I really, really find a great segue or a great entry into the book. It's just lovely. And I think all of your suggestions are really fun. And, you know, it's good to be the underdog, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And thank you for having me.
Yeah, yeah. So, gardeners, listeners, as you're looking through catalogs and seeing things that you wish you could have and want to have, check out Andrew's book for the better alternative so that you too can have that lush tropical or that arid and Mediterranean garden. So just keep gardening and visiting nurseries to expand your palette. Thank you, Andrew, for joining us and for writing such a great book. It's so fun and informative. Great analogies, great information. Thanks to Joe G for engineering. Thanks to Jack Inslee for producing and to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. Join us on Facebook at Groundworks Inc. We dig plants. Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.